Human Trafficking in Maine. Over the past decade, Maine has passed a number of laws aimed at combating human trafficking in the state, but advocates believe it remains a growing problem here. Those most often targeted by traffickers are among society's most vulnerable, from homeless teenagers to people affected by the opioid epidemic. Human trafficking takes on different forms. Sex trafficking is the most widely reported, but trafficking of labor happens in Maine as well, in agriculture, domestic work, and restaurants. I'm Jennifer Rooks. As law enforcement agencies sharpen their focus on trafficking, social service agencies work to reach survivors with the support and options they need to stay safe. Next on Maine Calling, we examine the scope and reality of human trafficking in our state. But first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio Studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Trafficking of humans for sex or for labor happens all over the state of Maine, but it is often hard to recognize and prosecute. Today, we'll find out why. Joining me in the studio, Daniela Cameron. She is Senior Director of Anti-Trafficking and Teen Services at Preble Street. Alicia Peters is an Associate Professor of Anthropology and Women's and Gender Studies at the University of New England. She's the author of Responding to Human Trafficking, Sex, Gender, and Culture in the Law. Also with us, Jessica. She's a survivor of trafficking and a peer support specialist with Greater Portland Health. In order to protect her privacy, we are only using her first name. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you known or suspected someone was being forced to work? Would you know what to do to help? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief, please brief, email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. And Alicia, I'll start with you. You know, we're having this conversation against the backdrop of this horrible story unfolding in England, where 39 people are dead. There are now people charged with many things, including manslaughter and also suspected trafficking in humans. I think these are the cases that a lot of people think about when they think about human trafficking. They think of these international crime rings doing these horrific things, but that's really just the tip of the iceberg, isn't it? So if you could put that in context for us, what is human trafficking? When we talk about it, what are we talking about?
Sure. This is really important because there's a lot of confusion and misunderstanding around what exactly human trafficking is. And I'm glad you brought up that case because it's one that has there have been headlines all over about how this is a suspected case of human trafficking. But what's interesting is when you read the stories, there's not actually, or I haven't seen yet, any evidence of actual trafficking. It certainly sounds like an unfortunate smuggling situation and ended really tragically, but it doesn't actually fit within the definition of trafficking. So I always rely on the federal definition of trafficking from the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. And it's very detailed, but essentially involves using force, coercion, or deception to exploit a person for labor. And those are really the key elements.
So they're not mutually, a smuggling case and a trafficking case, they're not mutually exclusive, but they are different things.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when you think about the larger, I always think about Venn diagrams where, you know, you might have smuggling, that circle including smuggling and migration, and human trafficking would be a small portion of that if there is an element where somebody's being exploited for their labor through force, fraud, or coercion.
And what are we seeing here, Daniela? What are the kind of cases in Maine that are trafficking cases?
Sure. Well, I was just going to add on to something that Alicia said first. It's just one easy way to understand the difference between smuggling and trafficking is that smuggling is a crime against a border. Trafficking is a crime against a person. And smuggling includes the element of choice. The person is choosing to cross over a border. And in trafficking, choice and power have been completely eliminated from a person's experience. So I just wanted to help make that clarification.
What does trafficking look like in Maine? What are the kind of cases that you
So at Preble Street, we've been doing anti-trafficking work now formally for about 6 years, and we've worked with over 200 survivors of trafficking, people of any age, any gender, all countries of origin, who've been trafficked for labor and for sex. Most of the cases that we've seen have been women trafficked for sex over the age of 25. All of them have been from Maine. But it's important to know that just because the majority of the cases that we've worked with have been people who have been trafficked for sex, it doesn't mean that we're not seeing labor trafficking. And I think we're going to talk a little bit about that later in the show. But, you know, when we talk about trafficking, we're talking about the exploitation of a person's labor, and traffickers recruit and control people based so much on their vulnerability, right? So the more marginalized you are in this community, the more likely you are to be recruited by a trafficker. And I think, you know, in the last few years, we've seen a huge intersection between the opioid epidemic and trafficking, and I think we might hear from Jess a little bit about that today. But you know, people who are vulnerable and struggling with substance use disorder are a great target for traffickers, so they can recruit and then use that opiate dependence to control them to work.
Well, Jess, I really appreciate you coming here today and being willing to tell your story. And I don't want to get in the way. Why don't you tell us what happened to you? And then also maybe reflect as you're telling it, do you feel as though your story is reflective of others?
Yeah, so I think that there are aspects of my story that are definitely reflective of other people's. And I also think that there are pieces of my story that are very different from other people's. I have been in positions where I've been trafficked multiple times, and so my substance use history has a lot to do with being placed in trafficking situations. I've been trafficked for labor and trafficked for sex, and so my need to obtain substances was a lot of, like, the position that I was put into. So people would give me drugs in order to be put in a position to, like, go out and sell their drugs for them, and I would get a little bit of the drugs. And that's a form of, like, going out and doing a little bit of work for them. And so I would be forced to go and sell a lot of drugs to get a very small amount of it. And then also, like, go and buy their groceries for them, go and do these other things, have them live in my house. I'd get put in a lot of really dangerous situations.
Would you be in a position where if you had tried to get out of that relationship, you would have been in danger?
Absolutely.
And I've read, or I understand, that many people who are survivors, victims or survivors, whatever word you choose to use, of trafficking, it starts very young, 13 or 14. Was that the case for you?
Not quite so young for me. I mean, I became homeless when I was 14. And so I was in a lot of, like, different situations throughout that time. For me, the trafficking stuff started when I was older. And so there was, like, different situations. I think for me, I didn't recognize that I was in a trafficking situation until I was out of it. And I think that that happens for a lot of people, that they don't really realize what's going on. It's more of, like, I need the substance, so I'm going to do whatever it takes to get to that point. And for me, the most dangerous situation I think I was put into was after my partner at the time had, like, stolen a lot of substances from somebody. And then I was put in a situation where it was, you need to pay this back. And so if I tried to leave, I was put in a situation where I was threatened with my life, and also my kids were threatened. And so it becomes really, really dangerous. And I was, you know, sold out for sex on a regular basis. Yeah, I was sexually assaulted over and over by the people who were trafficking me as well, and threatened every single day with my life. And so it becomes this situation where you are terrified to go anywhere, and also get put in a position where the substances aren't even being given to you anymore.
So were you living in Maine when this was happening?
I was living in Maine. I was also taken out of state multiple times too.
Oh, my gosh. Jessica, how did you break free? How did you get out of this cycle?
I wasn't out of the cycle until I was arrested.
Is this often what happens, Daniela, that an arrest is what changes the course?
I think it varies. The hope is that law enforcement isn't arresting someone they believe is a victim, right? But many times traffickers force criminality upon their victims, right? And so the victims are carrying all of the culpability of the crimes that are being committed, and then can get picked up on charges. And then sometimes, you know, so sometimes that break away from their trafficker is an opportunity to be safe. And, you know, we purposely do targeted outreach in jails because we know that there are plenty of people who are incarcerated who have been trafficked or maybe incarcerated and are still in the middle of a trafficking situation. And that's actually how Jess and I, we met was when she was incarcerated. I think there's been a history there's been a shift and a change in the way that law enforcement is trying to be more victim-centered in their approach. And again, I think we're going to hear more about that from
those partners.
Right,
and a shift in the law as well. I know just this year, Maine has passed a law in which somebody under 18 cannot be charged with prostitution.
Yeah, exactly. We were really happy and pleased with that outcome. It's taken a long time, but by definition, a person under 18 cannot consent to a commercial sex act. And so up until this year, a young person who engaged in a commercial sex act could be arrested for prostitution and also be defined as a victim of human trafficking by federal law. So we're really pleased that passed, and that instead of, you know, criminalizing a young person, that we're now more focused on how to provide access to services and support.
Alicia, I want to talk to you about how this focus is changing and how the language is changing from even 10 or 20 years ago when we use words like prostitution, when we use words like trafficking. How is it now that not only social service agencies, law enforcement agencies, academics think about the system that, has gone on and on some level since the beginning of human civilization?
Mm-hmm. There's a really long and complex history here, right? And the including the language of trafficking, but in terms of the way we use that now and as defined, you know, that term really came back into use during the late 1990s as advocates, both at the international and the national level, started to recognize this crime and system of abuses that were going on. So that term now, I think what's different is that it really does capture this idea of force and fraud and coercion. And that's a really important distinction, that we're not talking just about commercial sex, which is often what is conflated with human trafficking, but we're talking about both commercial sex and any other kind of labor where there is an element of force and control.
What are other kinds of, we talk about labor, what are some examples of the kind of labor that is most often seen? Are we talking about restaurants? Are we talking about maids? What kind of work is being coerced?
That's a great question. It can happen in any labor sector. There have been some really big cases involving forced work in agricultural settings, certainly domestic work. I know there have been some cases here in Maine involving domestic workers, and sometimes those are cases where you see some of the most isolation, right? People don't have an opportunity to report what's happening or for other people to observe what's going on because they are so isolated in somebody's home. Absolutely. We see it in restaurants. We see it in landscaping, in the fishing industry. It can really be anywhere where there's a vulnerable population.
And are we seeing it in those kind of sectors here in Maine? Are
yes.
we talking about yes?
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen we've had cases of trafficking within restaurants in Portland, within our agricultural sector in Maine, and we've had a handful of domestic servitude cases where, so just like Alicia explained, somebody that's been providing like the cooking, the cleaning, the childcare in a private home, unable to leave the house, not paid for any of their work, threatened with deportation, and then also victim of daily verbal and physical abuse.
You said threatened with deportation. I'm going to give you a minute here to get a drink of water.
Sorry,
but you,
you
said threatened with deportation. Is this because people who have come to the U.S. from other countries are more vulnerable and more at risk for this?
I don't think they're more at risk. I think anybody that is in our community who is vulnerable is at risk of trafficking. The domestic servitude cases that I just mentioned were workers who were undocumented. And so, again, that's their vulnerability. But it depends on the sector, just like Alicia said. So there are industries in Maine that have a higher number of workers who are of migrant workers. They're at huge risk of being exploited. And then there are populations in Maine who are struggling with poverty and substance use and mental health who are also at huge risk of being trafficked.
And I would just add one thing in terms of the example of domestic workers and the types of control that are used in that situation, that in addition to isolation or threats of reporting somebody to immigration authorities or that kind of thing, there's also, we see sexual abuse being used in labor trafficking situations. And that is something that's quite common in domestic worker trafficking cases as well. So we don't only see sexual abuse in trafficking involving commercial sex.
Jess, you've been nodding this whole time, and I want to ask you, as a in your role in providing peer support, what is it that you do with other survivors? How is it sometimes a matter of convincing them that they have been the victim of trafficking?
No, so it's not a matter of convincing anybody that they've been trafficked. I don't feel that that's ever my role.
I only asked you that because you had said that you didn't realize until you were out.
So I talk to people about like what their own experience is. I let them share whatever they're comfortable sharing. I don't ever try and dig anything out of anybody. I have talked to people about like where they're at. I relate to people about my own experience, and I only share anything that I feel might help them in being able to move through their experience. Tools that like I've been able to use to get through my own things if I feel that they might be able to benefit from it. If somebody is in a position where they are in need of a service because of what they're going through, I might say that I was able to benefit from the service, or do you know about this service, and connect them with something if I feel that it might be beneficial to them. If they're aware of what they are going through, then I will definitely talk about that and talk about how what that means for them, especially if they are just coming to understand that they are in a trafficking situation, because that, especially for me anyways, was a really overwhelming experience of what do you mean? What is this? No, I was just using substances. I was just in this situation with other drug dealers. So to really kind of understand that was a lot. I was shaking my head because for me, it was labor trafficking, it was sex trafficking, it was all intertwined together, and I've seen that in other people's situations as well. And so I think it's kind of important to consider that it can go hand in hand with each other, especially in the last situation that I was in. I was forced to do everything. I literally did their grocery shopping, I cooked for them, I cleaned for them. I did everything, and if I didn't, I was threatened with my life. I was beaten. I didn't sleep for days. I didn't eat. It was horrible, and so those are the things that can occur with trafficking situations. And that's why I was nodding my head. that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are talking about human trafficking here in Maine. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Breakwater, hosting a toddler through 8th grade open house on November 2nd. Details at school.breakwaterlearning.org. And UMaine's Collins Center for the Arts, with The Office, a musical parody, on November 3rd. Tickets at collinscenterforthearts.com. Dig if you will,
the picture. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Prince's biographer, Dan Pipenbring. Shortly before his death, Prince selected Pipenbring to help him write his memoir. The book includes pages Prince had written and left behind about his childhood and adolescence. Join us. An ocean of
violets in bloom. Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7. Are you a regular listener to Morning Edition? When you miss it, do you wish there was some way you could still hear it, even if it's not on the radio? Well, now you can, if you have an Alexa smart speaker. Just say, "Smart speaker, please play Morning Edition." Alexa will then ask you which station you want to hear, and you, of course, will say Maine Public Radio. And then Alexa will play back the last full hour of Morning Edition. So you can hear the most recent hour of Morning Edition with Erwin Gratz until 3 each afternoon. At this point in time, this is only for Alexa smart speakers. We'll let you know if Google Home learns how to do this. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Human Trafficking in Maine. In the studio with me, Daniela Cameron, who is Preble Street Senior Director for Anti-Trafficking and Teen Services. Alicia Peters is an Associate Professor at the University of New England and the author of Responding to Human Trafficking, Sex, Gender, and Culture in the Law. Also with us is Jessica. She is a survivor of trafficking and peer support specialist. We are only using her first name. We invite you to join the conversation. Our number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Jonathan Sarbeck. He is the district attorney for Cumberland County. Jonathan Sarbeck, thanks so much for calling in.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
How has the prosecution of trafficking cases changed over the past decade?
Well, first of all, just like Daniela mentioned, that they've been doing a lot of services since 2013, I would say that law enforcement didn't realize what an issue we had in Cumberland County and in Maine until around 2012, 2013. That's not to say at all that it wasn't happening, but to law enforcement really got involved when we started seeing it come about, and then talking to victims and finding out how much it was going on within Cumberland County that we started taking notice. And then at that point, the legislature started taking notice too, and created some laws that went specifically to sex trafficking.
Do you think that there's been a real shift in the way that prosecutors and law enforcement officers look at crimes such as prostitution?
Absolutely. I think now there's been that change in that paradigm when we are viewing people who are involved in prostitution more as victims as opposed to criminals. And it's a new way of looking at what's happening within the prostitution world. But yeah, I think law enforcement's definitely made a shift to view people who are involved as victims.
Are you seeing labor trafficking cases as well in your office?
Well, the labor trafficking statute is actually relatively new to Maine. It's been around at the federal level for some time, but they just recently created this labor trafficking statute. But as Daniela was saying earlier, that we have had seen information dealing with labor trafficking. In the past, those cases had to go to the feds. Now we can start handling those within our office and within the court system in Cumberland County.
How difficult is it to prosecute trafficking cases?
Prosecuting trafficking cases is quite difficult. From my experience as a prosecutor who's been doing this for a long time, and then also doing the human trafficking cases before I became the district attorney, I will say that victims of either sex trafficking or labor trafficking have to be some of the most difficult. They have some of the most difficult issues to handle. A lot of people come from situations where they, as you mentioned earlier, they fall into the prostitution world at a very young age. I believe the average age is between 11 and 13 years old. A lot of them have situations dealing with substance use issues or have had problems with some sort of sex abuse in their past, or also just a general distrust of law enforcement, and coming from a situation where they don't have much in support systems. That's why people and the good people over at Preble Street Anti-Trafficking Services are huge with helping us out to get victims those necessary services that are going to support them as we prosecute a case.
What do you want to say to people who think of prostitution as a victimless crime?
I want to say that there's always a human being on the other side, and it's not a victimless crime. Like I said, when you know that the average age of people who fall into prostitution is between 11 and 13 years old, at some point, I'd say the vast majority of people who are working in prostitution at some point were trafficked and were at some point victimized. And when you support the market in a way, you are supporting somebody continually to being victimized.
And if a listener is suspecting someone they know is being trafficked, what do you recommend they do?
Well, there's a variety of things. I mean, obviously, if there's an emergency situation, call 911. But if there's other information that people want to share and get and talk to other individuals about whether or not they're seeing what they're seeing is actually trafficking, you can call your local law enforcement on the non-emergency lines. You could also call the National Human Trafficking Resource phone number, which is 1-888-3737-888, or also you can report activity to Department of Homeland Security Investigations, which does a lot of work to try to save victims, and their number is 1-866-347-2423.
And we'll also have those on our website, Main Calling website. Jonathan Sarbeck, thank you so much for calling in today. Jonathan Sarbeck is the district attorney for Cumberland County here in Maine. And joining us now is Special Agent Christopher Peavy of the FBI. Agent Peavy, thank you for giving us a call.
No, thank you for having me.
Chris, what kind of cases does the FBI handle as opposed to local law enforcement here in Maine? Are these ones that cross state borders?
They can be. They have an interstate nexus, which can be a state border, or it can also be, a cell phone or things like that. And then with children, typically we don't need an interstate nexus to cross state borders. But what we try to do is work in parallel with our state and local partners.
Give us a sense of the kind of cases you see here in Maine.
We see a variety. So there are sex trafficking cases. I think as of a couple of years ago, the breakdown was probably 70-30 nationwide as far as sex trafficking versus labor trafficking. It's probably skewed more towards sex trafficking in Maine because that's typically what we've been looking for. But they can be individuals. They can be criminal groups like gangs that are engaged in sex trafficking, or they can be more national organizations that are engaged in it.
How long does it take to investigate one of these cases?
Oh, it takes years. So one of the things that I think John touched on was the difficulty in prosecuting these cases is that your victims in this case require so many supports and services and so much stabilization throughout this time that it makes it extraordinarily difficult because they have been basically cast aside by the trafficker with the intent that, well, no one's going to believe this person. So we have to stabilize that person while building our case, and that can take a couple of years.
Have you seen a shift in the way that the FBI handles these cases?
Yeah, in parallel with state and local agencies, I think that we have gone with the same model. Even, 10 years ago or so, there were sting operations where they would arrest women for prostitution. We'd work with them. We've established a more victim-centered approach where we do some of these operations that are essentially outreach operations, where we will contact women engaged in prostitution and then offer them services and then not arrest them either way. They don't have to accept services. So I think there has definitely been a shift towards humanizing the victim and trying for a resolution that might not necessarily result in a criminal prosecution.
I know this is probably a hard question to answer, but I'll pose it anyway. Do we have a sense of whether or not the human trafficking is increasing or decreasing here in this part of the world?
I don't know what increasing or decreasing. I think that we are identifying it more, and that's part of things like this is outreach, kind of demystifying what we do, and having people identify human trafficking where before they might not have dug deeper. They might have assumed it was just prostitution and someone engaged in it for their own profit versus someone who is not having their own choices being made for them. I think it's always been there, but we're just getting better, especially in Maine, at identifying it.
All right. Well, Agent Peavy, thank you so much for joining us today. That's Christopher Peavy. He is an FBI special agent calling in, talking about human trafficking today on Maine Calling. We have a question, an email from Jamian. Jamian asks, how is trafficking different from slavery? If not, why the different terms?
It's a good question. And in fact, sometimes the language of modern day slavery is actually applied to trafficking. But there are some really important differences. The term slavery has connotations to chattel slavery, right? Of people being held, something that was legally sanctioned by the state. And so when we're talking about trafficking, it's important to make those distinctions that often the ways in which people are being held in the situation are much more nuanced. So we often see, rather than somebody being physically restrained, although that can happen, someone's movement might be restricted, we see forms of psychological coercion that are present that can have just as much of an effect in keeping somebody in the situation.
Is there something either of you want to add to that? No. Okay. I want to talk about what the rest of us can do if people are listening and are thinking, I had no idea that this may be going on in my community. What are signs of trafficking? What are signs that something's not right?
Sure.
In your neighborhood or your community?
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, if someone is living at the same place that they are working, that's a sign of vulnerability, right? Because their access to their separation from work and where they live doesn't exist, right? So, we've gotten calls before where someone may have noticed that they've walked into a business and noticed that there were people, they've seen beds or they've seen someone showering in the basement of a restaurant, right? Those are like clear indicators that something isn't right. But if someone is presenting, with a controlling someone that's with them that seems controlling, they can't explain where they are, where they live, or they don't have access to their documents. Any of those things could be indicators. We work really, working really closely with our healthcare partners to increase identification, because one thing that we learned is that, and don't quote me on this stat, but it's something like, 80% of survivors of trafficking are seen by a healthcare professional while they're being trafficked, and only 1% are identified. And so and when someone's in a trafficking situation, the healthcare provider may be the only person, the only provider, only safe person that they have access to. And so it's really, really important that people dig into this issue and learn as much as they can. And even if it's just talking with someone today about the show that they listen to, so that we can sort of spread the word and raise awareness about this issue.
Jessica, are there questions that you could have been asked when you were in this situation that you would have been able to answer and sort of raised a red flag or, asked for help in a coded way?
I'm sure that there are. Why are people living in your house? even in like a medical setting, I think of the simple questions like, do you feel safe in your house? And those questions don't get asked as much as they should anymore. I even think just even recently about going to the hospital for something, and that question wasn't asked. And I just like had that reflection of, why isn't this being asked to people anymore? Because that can be just that simple moment of saying, know. Like, I don't. Or even just being able to observe how that person reacts physically, their facial reaction to it, their body, like, how did they respond to it? And having that provider notice those things and say, like, you know, I noticed maybe you're a little uncomfortable with that, you know, and having that moment with that person. And I think that's really important to have that. And I do think that providers could really pick up on some of that stuff.
All right. Well, we do need to take another break. If you have a question about human trafficking in Maine, give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Sweetgrass Farm Winery and Distillery, tasting wines and spirits in Union, Portland's Old Port, and at their new location in Kennebunk, sweetgrasswinery.com. Androscoggin Home Healthcare and Hospice, with expanded services in Augusta, including pediatric care and telehealth. More at androscoggin.org. And Diversions, Puzzles, and Games by Maine Mall, committed to bringing people together with new and classic games and a variety of puzzles. DiversionsGames.com. A special thanks to Michael from Standish for his donation of a 2006 Toyota Corolla. Donations to the Maine Public Car Donation Program make a big difference for your public radio station, and in most cases result in a tax deduction for you. Towing is free, and the great feeling you get from supporting the programming that you enjoy and count on is priceless. If you're wondering what to do with your car, please consider Maine Public. It's easy. Just go to mainepublic.org, click on Support, and then the Maine Public Vehicle Donation Program. Thanks. Coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, Maine Public Radio will broadcast a primary 2020 special, a candidate forum from The Exchange, from our friends at New Hampshire Public Radio. Featured is a conversation with Tom Steyer, who is campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination. That's coming up this afternoon at 2, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, efforts to address human trafficking in Maine. My guests are Daniela Cameron, who's Preble Street Senior Director of Anti-Trafficking and Teen Services. Alicia Peters is an Associate Professor of Anthropology and Women's and Gender Studies at UNE. And Jessica is with us. She is a survivor of trafficking and a peer mentor. We are not sharing her last name. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now, Catalina Biadrahita. She is a case manager with Preble Street's Anti-Trafficking Services in their Bangor office. Catalina, thanks for giving us a call.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We touched on this a little bit earlier, but I want to circle back to it. What are the impacts to immigrants and asylum seekers of what do you see in the field?
Immigrants are especially vulnerable because, first of all, they don't, their first language is not the English, so they can have this language barrier as the first place. It can be challenging for them to understand the laws and systems of a new country. They may not know their rights as workers or where to turn for help, or may not seek help due to fear of prosecution, deportation, and threats to their families back home, or fear of losing their ability to work in the United States.
You know, I think a lot of people may think of trafficking as sort of a big city issue, and here in Maine that means Portland. What are you seeing in Bangor and Aroostook County and eastern Maine, other parts of the state that you cover?
Well, the situation is not so different. I think we can see any form of trafficking, sex or labor trafficking, in these smaller cities. I think labor trafficking can be more visible in the rural area. So actually right now in the Bangor area, in the Penobscot and Piscataquis counties, there is a team that is working with sex trafficking victims with trying to provide them the better response in those cases. So I think this is not only for big cities. The thing is maybe that in the big cities you can get more reports.
All right. Well, Catalina Biedrahita, thank you so much for joining us. She is a case worker with, case manager with Preble Street's Anti-Trafficking Service in their Bangor office. Thank you, Catalina. We're going to go to John, who's calling from Wiscasset. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I heard the description of smuggling versus trafficking, and I'm wondering, those young people from, mostly young people from Vietnam, I believe it is, now, London's a very expensive city. What were they going to do in London if they got out of that container? I mean, you really need to see it all in the big context. There's no housing in London. They were going to be exploited in some way, no doubt. And they're dead now, and that's a tragedy. The other point I want to make is this thing about immigration in this country. There are too many questions about it. I don't listen much or follow or... I'm not a fan of Mr. Trump, but he's right when he says you should regulate immigration and have immigrants who are documented with their rights. There should be no gray area about this. And there is no housing. There's no housing. I live in West Cassett. There is no housing for anybody. There's another problem. People come into this state. I don't know. Maybe there's housing up in, I don't know, Adirondack or somewhere. I don't know where. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe no, Allegash. I mean, Allegash, maybe there's houses up there, but there's no housing in southern Maine. There's no available units. So people are being exploited. Fake marriages, that's another thing. You didn't mention that. Older men finding brides from China and other places, and they're in bondage at home.
John, I really appreciate your call. And Alicia, he really speaks to the interconnectedness of so many of the issues in our society today.
Absolutely. You know, it's a good question. So people who are being smuggled or fleeing their home countries because of violence or lack of economic opportunity, they are seeking those things in the destination countries where they're arriving. Absolutely. And I think the question when we're talking about trafficking or defining what fits the criteria for trafficking is how are those things connected, right? And I mean, they certainly are in the larger sense. But whether something constitutes trafficking has to do with the purpose that somebody is being smuggled. So if you have, you know, one individual or a group of smugglers who ultimately become the captors and are exploiting that labor, that is absolutely human trafficking. But there are much larger systemic issues in terms of employment and labor exploitation, of course.
All right, John, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Julia, who's calling from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Portland. Hi, Julia.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. My name is Julia Lopez. I'm with the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Portland, as you said, and I'm the office's human trafficking coordinator. And I just wanted to take a brief moment to thank you so much for bringing attention to this issue. The prosecution of human trafficking, both labor and sex, is one of the absolute priorities of our office. And it's with close partnerships with our state, local, federal law enforcement, and then the folks at Preble Street Anti-Trafficking Services that we've been able over the last several years to have some successful prosecutions and really hold traffickers to account. So I just, again, wanted to thank you for bringing attention to this important issue.
Julia, well, I have you on the phone, and thank you so much for calling in. What kind of sentences are you finding that people who are convicted of human trafficking end up with?
They're often very significant. We've had two recent sex trafficking convictions I can think of. One of the defendants received a 17-year sentence, and we had another recently who received a 26-year sentence. So the federal penalties for trafficking tend to be quite high.
All right. Well, Julia, thanks. Julia, did you say your last name is Lopez?
It is, yes.
Thank you so much for calling in, Julia Lopez from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Portland. going to a message here from Dana, an email. I work with a group called Thrive New England, centered here in Stanford. In Sanford, we are working with various schools, having a woman who came out of trafficking and a woman who is a master's in social work, going in and telling kids about trafficking, what it is, how to recognize it, how to avoid it, not to mention telling kids how valuable they are in this world. I have been recycling cans and bottles to help fund this work, having just retired from the post office. Thank you again, Dana. I think this is a really important thing to underline, telling kids how valuable they are in this world. Jessica?
That's awesome. I have not heard of that before, but that's amazing. I do believe that it is incredibly important to tell kids and everybody how valuable they are in the world. A lot of the work that I do in peer support is bringing to light, changing the way that we see who we are, and a lot of the purpose that we have in the world. The mental health system, and especially just like being homeless for a long time, and being out on the streets and just being in the world of substance use in general, for me anyways, brought my self-esteem really down. And my self-efficacy was like, I just didn't have any. It was really low. And so doing peer support is about bringing that back up. And it sounds like this is also about that. This is absolutely amazing. And it's Dana. Dana, thank you. That's amazing. And I'd love to hear more about it.
We have an email from Victoria Morales, who's a legislator. She writes, I sit on the Joint Standing Committee of the Legislature on Criminal Justice and Public Safety, and we are looking closely at two things. One, repealing crimes that result in the arrest and incarceration of adult victims of trafficking. And two, working to release many of the 250 women in prison in Maine today with housing and supports in their communities, the majority of whom have been trafficked and abused. Does this panel have advice for us? Jessica, I know this is something, her first question here is something you wanted to speak to, the repeal of crimes from those who've been arrested for prostitution and other kinds of crimes that are associated with trafficking.
Yeah, it is actually something I want to address. So for myself especially, you know, I obtained a criminal record throughout the time that I was being trafficked. And that's still something that I carry with me today. And it can become a major barrier. And it is definitely a barrier for many of the people that I know who have been trafficked. And it becomes a barrier for housing. It becomes a barrier for employment. It becomes a barrier for education. I am a full-time student. I almost have my bachelor's in psychology of addiction, and I'm going on for my master's. But it still becomes a barrier for me. And it becomes a barrier for anybody who is trying to obtain housing right now. So you can still get like a voucher for housing, but to try and actually get into an apartment, they pull that criminal record, and then somebody can't get housing. And so it's, how do we get rid of these records, right? Because you are still being trafficked. And I think that that's such a problem.
And Danielle, Alicia, I'll throw her other question out to you. What advice do you have working to release many of the women in prison today, the majority of whom have been trafficked and abused?
Well, I mean, I think housing is, like Jess is saying, housing is one of the biggest barriers for survivors to begin that journey of recovery. And so without safe and stable and affordable housing, it's nearly impossible to really get back on track. And I think for every survivor that we work with, that, you know, it's really critical that at the time we meet them and hear their story and ask them what they need help with, right? Whether it's with housing or with access to medical care or whatever, we start with that question of what justice means to them, right? And that looks different for every person. Some people want to see that their traffickers are held accountable, and some people want to get paid for their job, paid for their work. Some people want to just get that safe and stable housing. So it's really, you know, although we, you know, it's this is a the issues to fight trafficking are, of course, they're systemic. And we also have to remember to look for those sort of individual answers that can help people move forward.
All right. Well, we're getting short on time, and I know, Alicia, you wanted to address the statistic that I had read and that was also discussed during the program today, that the average age of somebody getting into prostitution was 13 or 14. That's actually not true.
It's not. And it is. It's one of those statistics that's repeated so frequently in the news and even by those in the field. And it's been disproven. In fact, the original researchers where that statistic came out of one of their publications have spoken out about it repeatedly and tried to get it out there that it came from a very small sample, a very particular population, and was not in any way generalizable in terms of being able to say that 13 to 14 is the average age of entry. And I think what's especially problematic about this statistic is that it holds this real moral weight because it deals with young girls, and it becomes part of this overall narrative about a very particular type of typical victim of trafficking, and the idea that human trafficking looks like one thing. And it really just doesn't capture the complexity of what human trafficking looks like and that anybody can be affected by it.
All right. We're going to end with a Facebook question from Lewis. He writes, how can people help people they think are being trafficked?
Do you want to answer that, Jess?
So I think this is a really complex question because it looks different for everybody. One is to be there and be supportive and to let go of the judgment, I think, is the biggest part, especially if there's a lot of, if it's sex trafficking. For me, there was a lot of like judgment around like prostitution work or whatever. You're doing this because you want to or because it's about the substances, and really just like let go of that judgment and be there and love the person, especially if they are someone that's a friend or a family member. Love them, ask them what they need, ask them what you can do for them, and just love them.
Just love them. At no point call 911.
I mean,
call the police.
If that's what they want. You know, mm-hmm. Be there for them. There are the services that are available, but also like trying to just like pull the person could be a really dangerous situation. I had a point where I had a friend who came, he knew what was going on, and he came to pull me from the situation, and it became very dangerous for me.
Well, thank you. That's very good information to end the program on. And thank you all for being guests here today on the program. The voice you just heard, Jessica, is a survivor of trafficking and now a peer mentor. Alicia Peters, also here, associate professor of anthropology and women's and gender studies at UNE, the author of Responding to Human Trafficking, Sex, Gender, and Culture in the Law. Daniela Cameron, our third guest, Senior Director of Anti-Trafficking and Teen Services at Preble Street. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn produced the program. Thanks to Dan DiPolito for his help with today's show. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.